Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. ID by Joyce Carol Oates. For an ID, they were saying, we need to see Lisette Mulvey. This was unexpected. In second period class at 9:40 a.m. on some damn Monday in some damn winter month she'd lost track of, when even the year, a new year, seemed weird to her, like a movie set in a faraway galaxy. It was one of those school mornings. Some older guys had got her high on beer for a joke. Well, it was funny, not just the guys laughing at her, but Lisette laughing at herself. Not mean laughing, she didn't think so, but like they liked her. Lisette was their name for her, high-pitched, piping like bats, and they'd run their fingers fast along her arms, her back, like she was scalding hot to the touch. They picked her up on their way to school. The middle school was close to the high school. Most times she was with a girlfriend, Keisha or Tanya. They were mature girls for their age, Keisha especially, and not shy like the other middle school girls. They knew how to talk to guys, and guys knew how to talk to them, but it was just talk, mostly. Now, was this math? Damn math class that Lisette hated. It made her feel so stupid. Not that she was stupid. It was just that sometimes her thoughts were as snarled as her hair, her eyes leaking tears behind her dark purple-tinted glasses. Prescription lenses, so that she couldn't see what the hell the teacher was scribbling on the board, not even the shape of it. Ms. Nowicki would say in her bright, hopeful voice, "Who can help me here? Who can tell us what the next step is?" And most of the kids would just sit on their asses staring, smirking, not wanting to be called on. But then Lisette was rarely called on in math class. Sometimes she shut her eyes, pretending that she was thinking really hard, and when she opened them, there was one of the three or four smart kids in the class at the board, taking the chalk from Nowicki. She tried to watch, and she tried to comprehend, but there was something about the sound of the chalk clicking on the board. Not a blackboard, it was green, and the numerals that she was expected to make sense of. She'd begin to feel dizzy. Her mother, Yvette, had no trouble with numbers. She was a blackjack dealer at the Casino Royale. You had to be smart and you had to think fast. You had to know what the hell you were doing to be a blackjack dealer. Counting cards. This was forbidden. If you caught somebody counting cards, you signaled for help. Yvette liked to say that one day soon she would change her name, her hair color, and all that she could about herself and drive out to Vegas, or to some lesser place like Reno, and play blackjack in such a way that they'd never catch on. Counting cards like no amateur could do. But if Lisette said, "You're going to take me with you, Mama, okay?" her mother would frown as if Lisette had said something really dumb and laugh. "Sweetie, I'm just joking. Obviously you don't fuck with these casino guys." Vegas or Reno wasn't where she'd gone this time. Lisette was certain of that. She hadn't taken enough clothes. In seventh grade, Lisette had had no trouble with math. She'd had no trouble with any of her school subjects. She'd got mostly B's, and her mother had stuck a report card, open like a greeting card, to the refrigerator. All that seemed long ago now. She was having a hard time sitting still. It was like red ants were crawling inside her clothes, in her armpits, and between her legs, stinging and tickling, making her itch, except that she couldn't scratch the way she wanted to, really hard with her fingernails to draw blood, and there was no point in just touching where her skin itched. That would only make it worse. The ridge of her nose where the cartilage and bone had been rebuilt, a numb sensation there, and her eye, her left eye, with its tears dripping out. "Lisette's crying! Hey, Lisette's crying! Why are you crying, Lisette?" They liked her, the older guys. That was why they teased her, like she was some kind of cute little animal, like a mascot. First time she'd seen J.C., Jimmy Chang. He'd transferred into her class in sixth grade. She'd nudged Keisha, saying, "Ooh," like in some MTV video, a moan to signal sex pain, though she didn't know what that was exactly. Her mother's favorite music videos were soft rock, retro rock, country and western, disco. Lisette had heard her in the shower sing moaning in a way she couldn't decipher, Was it angry or happy? Oh, she hated math class, hated this place. Sitting at her desk in the row by the windows at the front of the classroom made Lisette feel like she was at the edge of a bright-lit room looking in, like she wasn't a part of the class. Nowicki said, "It's to keep you involved up close like this, so Lisette wouldn't daydream or lose her way," but it had just the opposite effect. Most days Lisette felt like she wasn't there at all. She swiped at her eyes, shifted her buttocks, hoping to alleviate the stinging red ants. Nearly 15 damn minutes she'd been waiting for the teacher to turn her fat back so that she could flip a folded-over note across the aisle to Keisha, for Keisha to flip over to J.C. in the next row. This note wasn't paper, but a Kleenex, and on the Kleenex a lipstick kiss, a luscious grape-colored lipstick kiss for J.C. from Lisette. She'd felt so dreamy blotting her lips on the Kleenex, a brand-new lipstick, deep purple, which her mother knew nothing about, because Lisette, like her girlfriends, wore lipstick only away from home, and it was startling how different they all looked within seconds, how mature and how sexy. Out of the corner of her eye she was watching J.C., J.C. stretching his long legs in the aisle, silky black hair falling across his forehead. J.C. wasn't a guy you trifled with. Not J.C. or his posse. She'd been told. She'd been warned. These were older guys by a year or maybe two. They'd been kept back in school or had started school later than their classmates. But the beer buzz at the back of Lisette's head made her careless, reckless. J.C.'s father worked at the Trump Taj Mahal. Where he'd come from, somewhere called Beijing in China, he'd driven a car for some high government official. Or he'd been a bodyguard. J.C. boasted that his father carried a gun. J.C. had held it in his hand. Man, he'd fired it. A girl had asked J.C. if he'd ever shot anybody, and J.C. had shrugged and laughed. Lisette's mother had moved Lisette and herself to Atlantic City from Edison, New Jersey, when Lisette was 9 years old. She'd been separated from Lisette's father, but later Daddy had come to stay with them when he was on leave from the army. Then they were separated again. Now they were divorced. Lisette liked to name the places where her mother had worked. They had such special names. Trump Taj Mahal, Bally's, Harrah's, the Casino Royale. Except she wasn't certain if Yvette still worked at the Casino Royale, if she was still a blackjack dealer. Could be Yvette was back to being a cocktail waitress. It made Lisette so damn angry. You could ask her mother the most direct question, like, "Exactly where the hell are you working now, Mama?" And her mother would find a way to give an answer that made some kind of sense at the time, but melted away afterward like a tissue dipped in water. J.C.'s father was a security guard at the Taj. That was a fact. J.C. and his friends never approached the Taj, but hung out instead at the south end of the strip, where there were cheap motels, fast food restaurants, pawn shops, bail bond shops, and storefront churches with sprawling parking lots, not parking garages, so they could cruise the lots and the side streets after dark and break into parked vehicles if no one was watching. The guys laughed at how easy it was to force open a locked door or a trunk where people left things like, for instance, a woman's heavy handbag that she didn't want to carry while walking on the boardwalk. Assholes! Some of them were so dumb you almost felt sorry for them. Lisette was still waiting for Nowicki to become distracted. She was beginning to lose her nerve. Passing a lipstick kiss to J.C. was like saying, "All right, if you want to screw me, fuck me, whatever. Hey, here I am." Except maybe it was just a joke. So many things were jokes. You had to negotiate the more precise meaning later. If there was a later. Lisette wasn't into thinking too seriously about later. She wiped her eyes with her fingertips like she wasn't supposed to do since the surgery. "Your fingers are dirty, Lisette. You must not touch your eyes with your dirty fingers. There's a risk of infection." Oh, God, she hated how both her eyes filled with tears in the cold months and in bright light, like the damn fluorescent light in all the schoolrooms and corridors. So her mother had got permission for Lisette to wear her dark purple-tinted glasses to school. They made her look cool, like she was in high school, not middle school. 16 or 17, not 13. "Hell, you're not 13, are you? You?" one of her mother's man friends would say, eyeing her suspiciously. But, like, why would she want to play some trick about her age? He'd been mostly an asshole, this friend of her mother's. Chester. Chet. But he'd lent Mama some part of the money she'd needed for Lisette's eye doctor. This morning Lisette had had to get up by herself, get her own breakfast, frosted Wheaties in front of the TV, and she hated morning TV, cartoons and crap, or worse yet, news. She'd slept in her clothes for the third night in a row. Black t-shirt, underwear, wool socks. Dragged on her jeans, a scuzzy black sweater of her mother's with Taj embossed on the back in turquoise satin. And her boots. Checked the phone messages, but there were none. Friday night at 9, her mother had called. Lisette had seen the caller ID and hadn't picked up. Fuck you, going away. Why the fuck should I talk to you? Later, feeling kind of scared, hearing loud voices out in the street, she tried to call her mother's cell phone. But the call hadn't gone through. Fuck you, I hate you anyway. Hate you, hate you. Unless Mama brought her back something nice, like when she and Lisette's father went to Fort Lauderdale for their second honeymoon, and Mama brought back a pink coral-colored outfit, tunic, top, pants. Even with all that had gone wrong in Fort Lauderdale, Mama had remembered to bring Lisette a gift. Now it happened, and it happened fast. Nowicki went to the classroom door where someone was knocking, and quick! With a pounding heart, Lisette leaned over to hand the wadded Kleenex note to Keisha, who tossed it onto J.C.'s desk. J.C. blinked at the note like it was some weird beetle that had fallen from the ceiling, and without glancing over at Keisha or at Lisette, peering at him through her tinted glasses with a gesture like shrugging his shoulders, J.C. was so cool. All he did was shut the Kleenex in his fist and shove it into the pocket of his jeans. Any other guy, he'd open the note to see what it was, but not Jimmy Chang. J.C. was so accustomed to girls tossing him notes in class, he didn't have much curiosity about what it was that the snarl-haired girl in the dark glasses had sent him. Or maybe he already had a good idea what it was. Kiss, 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 kiss. The main thing was that J.C. hadn't just laughed and crumpled it up like trash. By now, Lisette's mouth was dry like cotton. This was the first time she'd passed such a note to J.C. or to any boy, and the beer buzz that had made her feel so happy and hopeful was rapidly fading. She'd had half a beer, maybe, swilling it down outside in the parking lot where the buses parked and fouled the air with exhaust, but the guys didn't seem to notice, loud talking and loud laughing, and she could see the way they looked at her sometimes. Lisette Mulvey was hot, except she'd spilled beer on her jacket. Beer stains on the dark green corduroy, which her mother would detect if she sniffed at him, whenever she returned home. This Monday in January, it was January, she'd lost track of the actual date like she'd lost track of the little piece of paper from the eye doctor that her mother had given her, for the drugstore, for the eye drops. This her mother had given her last week, the last time she'd seen her, maybe Thursday morning, or Wednesday. It was some kind of steroid solution that she needed for her eye after the surgery, but she couldn't find that piece of paper now, not in her jacket or in her backpack or in the kitchen or in her bedroom, not anywhere. Nowicki was at the door now, turning to look at. Who? Lisette? It was like a bad dream. Warrior singled out. Some stranger. A cop, it looked like, coming into your classroom to ask for you. Lisette, can you step out into the hall with us, please? Next to Nowicki was a woman in a uniform. Had to be Atlantic City PD. Hispanic features and skin color and dark hair drawn back tight and sleek in a knot. Everybody in the classroom was riveted now, awake and staring, and poor Lisette in her seat was paralyzed, stunned. She tried to stand, biting at her lip. Fuck, her feet were tangled in her backpack straps. There was a roaring in her ears, through which the female cop's voice penetrated, repeating what she said and adding, "Personal possessions, please," meaning that Lisette should bring her things with her. She wouldn't be returning to the classroom. So scared, she belched beer, sour, vomity beer taste in her mouth, and, oh Christ, what if the cop smelled her breath? In the corridor, a worse roaring in her ears, out of the woman's mouth came bizarre sounds. "ID, if you are Lisette Mulvey, come with me." ID, ID, like a gull's cry borne on the wind, rising and snatched away, even as you strained desperately to hear it. Turned out there were two cops who'd come for her. The Hispanic policewoman introduced herself, Officer Molina, like Lisette was going to remember this name, let alone use it. The other cop was a man, a little younger than the woman, his skin so acne-scarred you'd be hard put to say if he was white. Both of them looking at Lisette like, what? Like they felt sorry for her, or were disgusted with her, or what? She saw the male cop's eyes drop to her tight-fitting jeans with a red rag patch at the knee. then up again to her blank, terrified face. It wouldn't be note passing in math class that they'd come to arrest her for. Maybe at the Rite Aid the other day. Plastic lipstick tubes marked down to 69 cents in a bin. Lisette's fingers had snatched three of them up and into her pocket without her even knowing what she was doing. "You are Lisette Mulvey, daughter of Yvette Mulvey, yes?" Numbly, Lisette nodded. Officer Molina did the talking. Lisette was too frightened to react when the policewoman took hold of her arm at the elbow, not forcibly, but firmly, as a female relation might, walking Lisette down the stairs, talking to her in a calm, kindly, matter-of-fact voice that signaled, "You will be all right. This will be all right. Just come with us." "How recently did you see your mother, Lisette, or speak with your mother? Was it today?" "Today? What was today?" Lisette couldn't remember. "Has your mother been away, Lisette? And did she call you?" Lisette shook her head. "Your mother isn't away, but she isn't at home, is she?" Lisette tried to think. What was the right answer? A weird, scared smile made her mouth twist in the way that pissed off her mother, who mistook the smile for something else. Molina said, "When did you last speak with your mother, Lisette?" Shyly, Lisette mumbled that she didn't know. "But not this morning, before you went to school?" "No, not this morning." Lisette shook her head, grateful for something to say that was definite. They were outside, behind the school. A police cruiser was parked in the fire lane. Lisette felt a taste of panic. Was she being arrested, taken to juvie court? The boys in J.C.'s posse joked about juvie court. In the cold, wet air, she felt the last of the beer buzz evaporate. She hated how the cops, both cops, were staring at her, like they'd never seen anything so sad or so pathetic before, like she was some sniveling little mangy dog. They could see the pimply skin at her hairline and every knot in her frizz hair that she hadn't taken the time to comb or run a brush through, let alone shampoo, for 4 or 5 days. She hadn't had a shower either. That long, her mother had been away. Away for the weekend with who? That had been one of Mama's secrets. Could be a new friend, some man she'd met at the casino. There were lots of roving, unattached men in Atlantic City. If they won in the casino, they needed to celebrate with someone. And if they lost in the casino, they needed to be cheered up by someone. Yvette Mulvey was the one. Honey-colored hair, not dirt-colored like Lisette's, in waves to her shoulders, sparkling eyes, a quick, soothing laugh that a man wanted to hear. Not sharp and ice-picky, driving him up the wall. Lisette had asked her mother who she was going away for the weekend with, and Mama had said, "Nobody you know." But the way she'd smiled, not at Lisette but to herself, an unfathomable look on her face like she was about to step off a diving board into mid-air, had made Lisette think suddenly, "Daddy?" She knew that her mother was still in contact with her father. Somehow she knew this, though Mama had not told her. Even after the divorce, which had been a nasty divorce, they'd been in contact. That was because, as Daddy had explained to her, she would always be his daughter. All else might change, like where Daddy lived, and if Daddy and Mommy were married, but not that, not ever. So Lisette had persisted in asking her mother, was it Daddy she was going away with? Was it Daddy? Was it? Nagging at Mama until she laughed, saying, "Hell no! No way I'm seeing that asshole again." Her mother had gone away for the weekend. "I can trust you, Lisette, right?" she'd said, and Lisette had said, "Sure, sure you can." Alone in the house meant that Lisette could stay up as late as she wanted, and watch any TV channel she wanted, and lie sprawled on the sofa talking on her cell phone as much as she wanted. It was a short walk to the mini mall, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Vito's Pizzeria, Taco Bell, though it was easier just to defrost frozen suppers in the microwave and eat in front of the TV. The first night Keisha had come over, the girls had watched a DVD that Keisha brought and eaten what they could find in the refrigerator. "It's cool your mother's gone away. Where's she gone?" Lisette thought. Possibly her mother had gone to Vegas after all, with her man friend or whoever. This time of year, depressing, cold and wet by the ocean, the smartest place to go would be Vegas. She's got lots of friends there from the casino. She's welcome to go out there any time. She'd have taken me except for damn dumb school. So when did you last speak to her? The cops were staring at her now, waiting for an answer as she was guiltily faltering, fumbling. Could have been like just yesterday or the day before. Her heart thumped in her chest like a crazed sparrow throwing itself against a window, like the one she'd seen in a parking garage once, trapped up by the ceiling, beating its wings and exhausting itself. Yvette Mulvey was in trouble with the law. Was that it? The only court Lisette had been in was Ocean County Family Court. There, the judge had awarded custody to Yvette Mulvey and visitation privileges to Duane Mulvey. If something happened to Yvette Mulvey now, Lisette would be placed in a foster home. It wasn't possible for Lisette to live with her father, who was a sergeant in the U.S. Army, and last she'd heard was about to be deployed to Iraq for the third time. Deployed was a strange word, a strange sound. Deployed. Daddy hadn't meant to hurt her, she knew. Even Mama believed this, which was why she hadn't called 911. And when the doctor at the ER had asked Lisette how her face had got so bruised, her nose and eye socket broken, she'd said that it was an accident on the stairs. She'd been running and she'd fallen. Which was true. She'd been running and she'd fallen. Daddy shouting behind her, swiping with his fists, not meaning to hit her. But he'd been pissed. And all the things that Daddy had said afterward were what she'd wanted to hear. They'd made her cry. She'd wanted so badly to hear them. And your father? How recently did you see your father, Lisette? In the cruiser the male cop drove. Molina sat in the passenger seat, swiveled to face Lisette. Her cherry red lips were bright in her face, like something sparkly on a billboard that was otherwise weather-worn. Her sleek black hair shone like a seal's coat. Her dark eyes shone with a strange, unspeakable knowledge. It was an expression that Lisette saw often on the faces of women, usually women older than her mother, when they looked at her, not in disapproval, but with sudden sympathy, seeing her. Lisette was uneasy with the expression. She'd seen it on Nowicki's face, too. Better was a look of disgust, dismay. Must have been 2-3 times that Molina explained to Lisette where they were taking her, to the hospital for the ID. But the words hadn't come together in a way that was comprehensible. ID. ID. We will stay as long as you wish, or not long at all. It's up to you. Maybe it will be over in a minute. Molina spoke to Lisette in this way, which was meant to soothe but did not make sense. No matter the words, there was a meaning beneath them that Lisette could not grasp. Sometimes adults were uncomfortable with Lisette because they thought she was smirking, but it was just the skin around her left eye, the eye socket that had been shattered and repaired, and the frozen look of that part of her face because some of the nerve muscles were dead. Such a freak accident, her mother had said. Told her and told her not to run on the stairs. You know how kids are. And half pleading with the surgeon, though she already knew the answer to the question, will they heal ever, the broken nerves? Not broken, but dead. At the hospital, they parked at the rear of the building. In a lowered voice, Molina conferred with the male cop. Lisette couldn't hear what they were saying. She had no wish to hear, but she wanted to believe that the Hispanic woman was her friend and could be trusted. It was like that with Hispanic women, the mothers of her classmates. Mostly they were nice. They were kind. Molina was a kind woman. You could see how she'd be with children and possibly grandchildren. Weird that she was a cop and carried a gun. Packed heat, it was said. Lisette's mother knew some cops. She'd gone out with a cop. She said that the life of a cop was so fucking boring. Once in a while something happened and happened fast and you could be shot down in a second or two. But mostly it was very, very boring, like dealing blackjack cards to assholes who think they can win against the house. You never win against the house. They were standing just inside the hospital on the first floor by the elevators. People moved around them, past them, like blurs in the background of a photograph. It seemed urgent now to listen to what Molina was telling her as she gripped Lisette's arm again. Did Molina think that Lisette was going to try to escape? The male cop held himself a little apart, frowning. What Molina was saying did not seem relevant to the situation, but later Lisette would see that, yes, everything that the policewoman had said was relevant. Asking Lisette about Christmas, which was maybe 2 or 3 weeks earlier, and New Year's, and what had Lisette and her mother done over the holidays? Anything special? Lisette tried to think. Holidays wasn't a word that she or Mama would use. Just saw some people, nothing special. You didn't see your father? No. When was the last time you saw him? Lisette tried to think. He'd been gone by the time of the face surgery and the eye surgery. She'd been out of school. Must have been the summer, like around July 4th. Not more recently than that? Lisette swiped at her eye, wondering, was this kind of trick like you saw on the TV cop shows? On New Year's Eve, did your mother go out? Yes, sure. Mama always went out New Year's Eve. Do you know who she went out with? No. He didn't come to the house to pick her up? Lisette tried to think. If whoever it was had come to the house, for sure Lisette had hid from him, just like she hid from Mama's women friends. And why? No reason, just wanted to. Lisette, how big you're getting! Lisette, taller than your mom, eh? They took the elevator down to the floor marked morgue. Here the hospital was a different place. The air was cooler and smelled of something like chemicals. There were no visitors. There were very few hospital staff people. A female attendant in white pants, a white shirt, and a cardigan sweater told them that the assistant coroner would be with them soon. They were seated. Lisette was between the two cops, feeling weak in the knees, sick, like she'd been arrested. She was in custody, and this was a trick to expose her. Casually, for she'd been talking of something else, Molina began to ask Lisette about a motel on the south edge of the city, the Blue Moon Motel on Atlantic. Had Lisette heard of the Blue Moon Motel? Lisette said no, she had never heard of the Blue Moon Motel. There were motels all over Atlantic City, some of them sleazy places, and she did not think, as Molina seemed to be saying, that her mother had worked at any of these motels ever. If Yvette Mulvey had worked at the Blue Moon Motel, she'd have heard of it. She had not. Lisette said that her mother was not a motel maid or a cocktail waitress, but a blackjack dealer, and you had to be trained for that. Lisette said, like she was groping for a light switch, "Is Mama in some kind of trouble?" A twisty little knot of rage in her heart against Mama. All this was Mama's fault. Molina said that they weren't sure. That was what the ID might clear up. "We need your cooperation, Lisette. We are hoping that you can provide identification." Weird how back at the school she'd heard ID, not ID. It was like static was interfering to confuse her. Like she had fallen on the stairs and hit her face and her head, and she hadn't been able to walk without leaning against a wall, she'd been so dizzy, and she'd forgotten things. Some short circuit in her brain. "Can you identify these? Do these look familiar, Lisette?" A morgue attendant had brought Molina a box containing items, of which two were a woman's handbag and a woman's wallet. Molina lifted them carefully from the box with gloved hands. Lisette stared at the handbag and the wallet. What were these? Were they supposed to belong to her mother? Lisette wasn't sure if she had ever seen them before. She stared at the brown leather handbag with some ornamentation on it, like a brass buckle, and straps, and the black wallet, shabby looking like something you'd see on a sidewalk or by a dumpster, and not even bothered to pick up to see if there was money inside. Molina was saying that these items had been retrieved from a drainage ditch behind the Blue Moon Motel. Also behind the drainage ditch was a woman's body, a badly damaged woman's body for which they had no identification yet. Carefully, Molina spoke. Her hand lay lightly on Lisette's arm, which had the effect of restraining Lisette from swiping and poking at her left eye as she'd been doing. "The purse has been emptied out and the lining is ripped. In the wallet was a New Jersey driver's license issued to Yvette Mulvey, but no credit cards or money, no other ID. There was a slip of paper with a name and a number to be called in case of emergency, but that number has been disconnected. It belonged to a relative of your mother's who lives or lived in Edison, New Jersey? Iris Peterson?" Lisette shook her head. This was all too much, just too much for her to absorb. She didn't recognize the handbag and she didn't recognize the wallet, she was sure. She resented being asked. These items were so grungy-looking, it was an insult to think that they might belong to her mother. Close up, she saw that Molina's eyes were beautiful and dark, thick-lashed, the way Lisette's mother tried to make hers with a mascara brush. The skin beneath Molina's eyes was soft and bruised-looking, and on her throat were tiny, dark moles. It did not seem right that a woman like Molina, who you could tell was a mother, her body was a mother's body for sure, wide hips and heavy breasts straining at the front of her jacket, could be a cop. It did not seem right that this person was carrying a gun in a holster attached to a leather belt and that she could use it if she wanted to, anytime she wanted to. Lisette went into a dream, thinking that if she struck at Melina, if she kicked, spat, or bit, Melina might shoot her. The male cop, you'd expect to have a gun. You'd expect he would use it. Daddy had showed them his guns, the ones he'd brought back from Iraq. These were not army issue, but personal guns, a pistol with a carved wood handle and a heavier handgun, a revolver. He'd won these in a card game, Daddy said. Maybe he hadn't brought them from Iraq. Maybe he'd got them at Fort Bragg, where he was stationed. Lisette was saying that if her mother's driver's license had been in that wallet, maybe it was her mother's wallet, but definitely she didn't recognize it. As for Iris Peterson, Aunt Iris, that was her mother's aunt, not hers. Aunt Iris was old enough to be Lisette's grandmother, and Lisette hadn't seen her in years and did not think that her mother had either. For all they knew, the old lady was dead. We tried to contact her, and the Edison police tried to contact her, but... An ID by someone who knew Yvette Mulvey well was necessary, Molina said, to determine if, in fact, the dead woman was Yvette Mulvey, or another woman of her approximate age. The condition of the body and the injuries to the face made it difficult to judge from the driver's license photo, or from the photos on file at the casinos where Yvette Mulvey had worked. Molina went on to tell Lisette that they tried to locate her father, Duane David Mulvey, to make the ID for them, but he was no longer a resident of Edison, or so far as they knew, of the state of New Jersey. Lisette said, "My father's in the U.S. Army. My father is a sergeant in the U.S. Army. He used to be stationed at Fort Bragg, but now he's in Iraq." And Molina said, "No, Lisette, I'm afraid that has changed. Your father is no longer a sergeant in the U.S. Army, and he is no longer in Iraq. The Army has no record of Duane Mulvey at the present time. He's been AWOL since December 26th of last year." Lisette was so surprised she couldn't speak. If Molina hadn't been gripping her arm, she'd have jumped up and run away. She was shivering. The corduroy jacket wasn't really for winter, this nasty wet cold. Mama hadn't been there that morning, scolding her, "Dress warm! For Christ's sake, it's January!" Another morgue attendant, an Indian-looking man, some kind of doctor, had come to speak in a low voice to the police officers. Quickly, Lisette shut her eyes, not listening, trying to picture the classroom she'd had to leave. There was Nowicki at the board with her squeaky chalk, and there was J.C. slouched in his desk, hair in his face, and Keisha, who breathed through her mouth when she was excited or scared. And there was Lisette's own desk, empty. Though now it was later, it was third period, and J.C. wasn't in Lisette's English class, but there was always a cafeteria. When the bell rang at 11:45 a.m., it would be lunchtime, and she'd line up outside the doors, with the smell of greasy food, French fries, macaroni and cheese, chili on buns. Lisette's mouth flooded with saliva. She smiled, seeing the purple lipstick kiss on the Kleenex as J.C. would see it when he unfolded it. A surprise! Her mother didn't want her to wear lipstick, but fuck Mama. All the girls her age did. Last time she'd seen Mama with Daddy, Daddy had been in his soldier's dress uniform and had looked very handsome. His hair had been cut so short. Not then, but an earlier visit, when Daddy had returned from Iraq for the first time. Lisette's mother had covered his face in purple lipstick kisses. Lisette had been so young she thought that the lipstick kisses were some kind of wound, that her daddy was hurt and bleeding. The times were confused. There were many times. There were many daddies. She could not see them all. There was a time Daddy took Mama to Fort Lauderdale. They'd wanted to take Lisette, but it hadn't worked out. Lisette had had to be in school at that time of year. She'd gone to stay with her mother's friend Misty, who worked at Bally's. They were planning on 10 days in Florida, but Lisette's mother had surprised her by returning after just a week, saying that that was it. That was the end. She'd had to call the police when he got drunk and beaten her, and in a restaurant he'd knocked over a chair, he was so angry. That was it for her, no more. Yvette had had man friends she'd met in the casinos. Most of them Lisette had never met, never wished to meet. One of them was a real estate agent in Monmouth County. Lisette could almost remember his first name. It was something unusual, like Upton, Upwell. The Indian man looked very young to be a doctor. Behind his wire-rimmed glasses, his eyes were soft black, somber. His hair was black, but coarse, not silky fine like J.C.'s hair. He was leading the cops and Lisette into a refrigerated room. Molina had a firm hold on Lisette's hand. "We will make it as easy for you as we can, Lisette. All you have to do is squeeze my hand. That will mean yes." "Yes? Yes, what?" Desperately, Lisette was picturing the school cafeteria, the long table in the corner where the coolest guys sat, J.C. and his friends, and sometimes certain girls were invited to sit with them. Today, maybe J.C. would call Lisette over to sit with them. "Lisette! Hey, Lisette!" Because he'd like the purple lipstick kiss and what it promised. "Take your time, Lisette. I'll be right beside you." Then, so quick, it was over. The female body she was meant to ID was not anyone she knew, let alone her mother. This one had hair that was darker than Yvette's, with brown roots showing, and it was all matted like a cheap wig, and the forehead was so bruised and swollen, and the eyes, you could hardly see the eyes, and the mouth was, like, broken. You couldn't make sense of the face, almost. It was a face that needed to be straightened out, like with pliers. "No, not Mama." Lisette spoke sharply, decisively. Molina was holding her hand. She was tugging to get it free. This was the morgue. This was a corpse. This was not a woman, but a thing. You could not really believe that it had ever been a woman. Only the head and the face were exposed. The rest of the body was covered by a white sheet, but you could see the shape of it, the size. And it was not Lisette's mother, obviously. Older than Mama, and something had happened to the body to make it small, smaller. Something sad, pathetic, broken female like debris washed up on the shore. It was lucky the sheet was drawn up over the chest, the breasts and the belly and the pubic hair, the fat rattled thighs of a woman of this age you would not want to look at. Guys were quick to laugh to show their contempt. Any girl or woman who was not good-looking, who was flat-chested or a little heavy, she had to walk fast to avoid their eyes. "This is not Mama. This is no one I know." Molina was close beside Lisette, instructing her to take her time. It was very important, Molina was saying, to make an ID of the woman, to help the police find out who had done these terrible things to her. Lisette pulled free of Molina. "I told you, this is not Mama. It is not." Something hot and acid came up into her mouth. She swallowed it down. She gagged again and swallowed, and her teeth chattered like dice being shaken. She wanted to run from this nasty room, which was cold like a refrigerator, but smelled of something sweet, sickish, like talcum powder and sweat, but Molina detained her. They were showing her some clothes now from the box, dirty, blood-stained clothes like rags, and a coat that resembled her mother's red suede coat, but was filthy and torn. It was not the stylish coat that Mama had bought a year ago in the January sales at the mall. Lisette said she had never seen any of these things before. She had not. She was breathing funny like her friend Keisha, who had asthma, and Molina was holding her hand and saying things to comfort her. Bullshit things, telling her to be calm. It was all right. If she did not think that this woman was her mother, it was all right. There were other ways to identify the victim. Victim. This was a new word, like corpse, drainage ditch. Molina led her to a restroom. Lisette had to use the toilet fast. Her insides had turned to liquid fire and had to come out. At the sink she was going to vomit, but could not. Washed and washed her hands. In the mirror a face hovered, a girl's face, in purple-tinted glasses, her lips a dark grape color. The scarring around the left eye wasn't so visible if she didn't look closely, and she had no wish to look closely. There had been 3 surgeries, and after each surgery, Mama had promised, "You'll be fine. You'll look better than new." They wanted to take her somewhere, to family services. She said that she wanted to go back to school. She said that she had a right to go back to school. She began to cry. She was resentful and agitated, and she wanted to go back to school, and so they said, all right for now, Lisette," and they drove her to school. The bell had just rung for lunch, so she went directly to the cafeteria, not waiting in line, but into the cafeteria without a tray, and still in her jacket, and in a roaring sort of haze, she was aware of her girlfriends at a nearby table. There was Keisha, looking concerned, calling, "Lisette, hey, what was it? You okay?" And Lisette said, laughing into the bright, buzzing blur, "Sure I'm okay. Hell, why not?" And that story was ID by Joyce Carol Oates, from the Best American Short Stories of the Year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The Stranger by Rainer Maria Rilke. A stranger has written me a letter. Not of Europe has the stranger written me, nor of Moses, nor of the great or the small prophets, nor of the Emperor of Russia, nor of the Tsar, Ivan the Terrible, his awful ancestor. Not of the mayor or of our neighbor the cobbler, not of the nearby town, not of the far towns, and even the forest with the many deer in which every morning I lose myself is not mentioned in his letter. He tells me nothing about his little mother or about his sisters, who have probably married long ago. Perhaps his little mother is dead. How else could it be that in a 4-page letter I find her nowhere mentioned? He shows a much, much greater confidence in me. He makes me his brother. He tells me of his need. In the evening the stranger comes to see me. I light no lamp. I help him off with his coat and beg him to drink tea with me, for it is just the hour at which I daily drink my tea. And on such intimate visits one may be at ease. As we are about to sit down, I notice that my guest is restless. His face is full of fear and his hands tremble. "Quite so," say I. "Here is a letter for you." And then I begin to pour out the tea. "Do you take sugar? And lemon, perhaps? In Russia I learned to drink tea with lemon. Will you try?" Then I light a lamp and place it in a far corner, rather high, so that really twilight remains in the room, only somewhat warmer than before, a rosy twilight. And therewith my guest's face seems more certain, warmer, and by far more familiar. I welcome him once more with the words, "You know I have been expecting you for a long while." And before the stranger has time to be astonished, I explain, "I know a story which I would like to tell no one but you. Do not ask me why, only tell me whether your chair is comfortable, and whether the tea is sweet enough, and whether you want to hear the story." My guest had to smile. Then he said simply, "Yes." "To all three questions, yes?" "To all three." We both leaned back simultaneously in our chairs so that our faces became shadowy. I put my glass down, rejoiced at the golden glint of the tea, slowly forgot this joy again, and asked suddenly, "Do you still remember God?" The stranger reflected. His eyes sank deep into the darkness, and with the little points of light in the pupils they resembled two long tree-lined avenues in a park, over which summer and sun lie luminous and broad. "These too begin so, with round twilight, stretching in always narrower darkness up to a distant shimmering point, the exit on the far side to a perhaps still brighter day." While I was realizing this, he said, hesitating, and as though he only reluctantly used his voice, "Yes, I still remember God." "Good," I thanked him, "for it is with him that my story deals. But first tell me, do you sometimes talk to children?" "Well, yes, occasionally, just in passing, at least." "Perhaps you know that God, in consequence of some horrid disobedience of his hands, does not know what a finished man really looks like?" "I heard that once somewhere, but I don't know from whom," my guest replied, and I saw uncertain memories driving across his brow. "No matter," I broke in, "listen to the story." A long time God endured this uncertainty, for his patience is great as his strength. Once, however, when dense clouds had lain between him and the earth for many days, so that he hardly knew any more whether he had not merely dreamed everything, the world and men and time, he called his right hand, which had so long been banished from his sight and hidden in small, insignificant works. It came willingly, for it believed that God wanted at last to forgive it. When God saw it there before him in its beauty, youth, and strength, he was indeed tempted to forgiveness. But he remembered in time and commanded without looking at it, "You are to go down to earth. You are to take on the form you will see there among men, and to stand naked upon a mountain so that I can observe you closely. As soon as you arrive below, go to a young woman and say to her, but quite softly, 'I want to live.' At first there will be a little darkness about you, and then a great darkness, which is called childhood, and then you will be a man and climb the mountain as I have commanded you. All this will last but a moment. Farewell." The right hand then took leave of the left, called it many pleasant names. Indeed, it has even been declared that it suddenly bowed down before it and said, Hail, Holy Ghost. But here St. Paul stepped up and smote off God's right hand, and an archangel caught it up and bore it away under his wide mantle. But God held the wound, too, with his left hand, so that his blood should not stream over the stars and thence fall down in sorrowful drops on the earth. A short time after, God, watching attentively all that went on below, saw that men in iron garments were busying themselves about one mountain more than all others, and he expected to see his hand climb up there. But there came only a man in, as it seemed, a red cloak, who was dragging upwards some black swaying thing. At the same instant, God's left hand, lying over his open wound, began to grow restless, and suddenly, before God could prevent it, left its place and rushed about madly among the stars, crying, "O poor right hand, and I cannot help you!" Therewith it tugged hard at God's left arm, on the very end of which it hung, and tried to tear itself free. And the whole earth was red with God's blood, and it was impossible to see what was happening beneath it. At that time God had very nearly died. With a last effort he called his right hand back. It came pale and trembling, and lay down in its place like a sick animal. And even the left hand, which already knew a good deal, since it had recognized the right down on earth as it toiled up the mountain in a red cloak, could not learn from it what had further happened on that hill. It must have been something terrible, for God's right hand is not yet recovered from it, and suffers under its memories no less than under the old wrath of God, who has still not yet forgiven his hands. My voice took a little rest. The stranger had covered his face with his hands. Thus everything stayed for a long time. Then the stranger said in a voice I had long known, "And why have you told me this story? Who else would have understood me? You come to me without rank, without office, without temporal honors, almost without a name. It was dark as you came in, yet I noticed in your features a resemblance." The stranger looked up, questioning. "Yes," I answered his silent gaze. "I often think perhaps God's hand is again on its way." The children have heard this story, and apparently it was told them in such a way that they could understand everything, for they love this story. And that was The Stranger by Rainer Maria Rilke from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. A Work of Art, A Story of a Gift by Anton Chekhov. Alexander Smirnov, the only son of his mother, holding his hand in some object carefully wrapped in a newspaper, an angelic smile on his youthful face, entered the consulting room of Dr. Koshlikov. "Ah, dear youth," exclaimed the doctor, "how are you? What is the good news?" Confused and excited, the young man replied, "Doctor, my mother is sending her regards. I am her only son, you know. You saved my life, your skill. We hardly know how to thank you." "Say no more, dear boy," said the doctor, beaming with delight. "I have only done my duty. Anybody else would have done the same." "I'm the only son of my mother. We are poor, and of course cannot repay you for your labors as you have deserved, and we feel it deeply. At the same time, my mother, I am her only son, doctor, my mother humbly begs you to accept as a token of our gratitude a little statuette she values very highly. It is a piece of antique bronze and a rare work of art." "My good fellow," commenced the physician. "No, doctor, you must not refuse," continued Alexander, unfolding his parcel. "You will deeply offend mother and myself, too. It's a little beauty, a rare antique. We have kept it in memory of father, who was a dealer in antique bronzes. My mother and myself continued the business." Finally, the youth succeeded in freeing his present from its wrappings and placed it on the table with an air of great solemnity. It was a moderately tall candelabrum of antique bronze and of artistic workmanship. It represented two female figures somewhat scantily attired and bearing an air of frivolity to describe which I have neither the required daring nor the temperament. The figures smiled coquettishly and looked as if they were ready to jump on the floor and to engage in some wild frolic were they not restrained by the task of supporting the candle holder. The doctor regarded his present for a few moments in silence, then scratched his head and coughed irresolutely. "A beautiful article, to be sure," he finally said. "But you know, what shall I say? Why, it's hardly the thing, you know. Talk of déshabille. This is beyond the bounds of propriety. The devil!" "Well, why? Now, how could I put a thing like that on my table? It will corrupt my residence." "Doctor, you surprise me," answered Alexander with an offended tone. "What queer views of art! This is a work of art. Look at it. What beauty! What delicacy of workmanship! It fills the soul with joy merely to look at it. It brings tears to one's eyes. Observe the movement, the atmosphere, the expression." "I fully appreciate it, my boy," interrupted the physician. "But you know I'm a man of family. I've children, a mother-in-law. Ladies call here." "Of course, if you look at it from the point of view of the common herd, you might regard it in a different light. But I beg of you, rise above the mob. Your refusal would hurt the feelings of my mother and of myself. I am her only son. You saved my life. We are asking you to accept something we hold very dear. I only deplore the fact that we have no companion piece to it." "Thank you, dear fellow, and thank your mother. I see that I cannot reason with you. But you should have thought of my children, you know, and the ladies. But I fear you will not listen to arguments." "No use arguing, doctor," replied the grateful patient, made happy by the implied acceptance. "You put it right here, next to the Japanese vase. What a pity I have not the pair. What a pity!" When his caller departed, the doctor thoughtfully regarded his unwelcome present. He scratched his head and pondered. "It is an exquisite thing, without doubt. It would be a pity to throw it into the street. It is quite impossible to leave it here, though. What a dilemma to be in! To whom could I give it? How to get rid of it?" Finally, he bethought himself of Ukov, a dear friend of his school days and a rising lawyer, who had just successfully represented him in some trifling case. "Good," said the doctor. "As a friend, he refused to charge me a fee, and is perfectly proper that I should make him a present. Besides, he's a single man and tremendously sporty." Losing no time, the doctor carefully wrapped up the candlestick and drove to Ukov. "There, old chap," he said to the lawyer, whom he happily found at home, "there I have come to thank you for that little favor. You refused to charge me a fee, but you must accept this present in token of my gratitude. Look, what a beauty!" On seeing the present, the attorney was transported with delight. "This beats everything," he fairly howled. "Hang it all, what inventive genius! Exquisite, immense! Where did you get such a little gem?" Having expressed his delight, the lawyer anxiously looked at his friend and said, "But you know you must not leave this thing here. I cannot accept it." "Why?" gasped the doctor. "You know my mother calls here, clients too. Why, I would not dare to look my servants in the face. Take it away." "Never, you must not refuse," exclaimed the physician with the energy of despair. "Look at the workmanship, look at the expression. I will not listen to any refusals. I will feel insulted." With these words, the doctor hurried out of the house. "A white elephant," the lawyer mumbled sadly, while the doctor, rubbing his hands with glee, drove home with an expression of relief. The attorney studied his present at length and wondered what to do with it. "It is simply delicious, but I cannot keep it. It would be vandalism to throw it away, and the only thing to do is to give it away. But to whom?" "I have it now," he fairly shouted. "The very thing, and how appropriate. I will take it to Shashkin, the comedian. The rascal is a connoisseur in such things, and this is the night of his jubilee." In the evening, the candelabrum, carefully wrapped, was taken to Shashkin's dressing room by a messenger boy. The whole evening that dressing room was besieged by a crowd of men who came to view the present. An incessant roar of delight was kept up within, sounding like the joyous neighing of many horses. Whenever an actress approached the door leading to the sanctum and curiously knocked, Shashkin's hoarse voice was heard in reply, "No, my dear, you can't come in. I am not fully dressed." After the performance, Shashkin shrugged his shoulders and said, "What on earth shall I do with this disreputable thing? My landlady would not tolerate it in the house. Here, actresses call to see me. This is not a photograph. You can't hide it in the drawer." The hairdresser listened sympathetically while arranging the comedian's hair. "Why don't you sell it?" he finally asked the actor. "A neighbor of mine, an old lady, deals in such things, and she will pay you a good price for it. An old woman by the name of Smirnov. The whole town knows her." Shashkin obeyed. 2 days later, Dr. Koshelkov sat peacefully in his study, enjoying his pipe and thinking of things medical, when suddenly the door of his room flew open, and Alexander Smirnov burst upon his sight. His face beamed with joy. He fairly shone, and his whole body breathed inexpressible content. In his hands he held an object wrapped in a newspaper. "Doctor," he began breathlessly, "imagine my joy. What good fortune! Luckily for you, my mother has succeeded in obtaining a companion piece to your candelabrum. You now have the pair complete. Mother is so happy. I am her only son, you know. You saved my life. Trembling with joy and with excess of gratitude, young Smirnov placed the candelabrum before the doctor. The physician opened his mouth, attempted to say something, but the power of speech failed him, and he said nothing. And that story was A Work of Art by Anton Chekhov, from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44 from the year 2020, edited by Bill Henderson. The Ugly American by Shara Leslie. Petra. The boys beat the Jennet because they could, out of boredom, because she was in heat. They beat her with sticks and switches and clods of dirt, because revolution had stalled the usual parade of buses, and there were no tourists to ferry up 800 rock-cut steps to the monastery. They pinned her against a cliff and beat her. Only a woman, very pregnant, saw, who'd left her husband snapping photos near Kasr el-Bint, left him in search of shade, somewhere to rest. And when the boys cheered and laughed and thrust their hips and whipped the jennet, baiting their donkeys to mount her, the woman, too, picked up a stone, though she was half a field away. She heard herself curse, think every stupid, soulless thing she'd heard about the filth born of this region. And when a man, an uncle, cousin, came charging, freed the jennet as a braid when loped, when he berated the boys, driving them off, the woman watched them saunter toward the village trail. As they joked and kicked up sand, it was then she felt deep within the son she had forgotten. Please understand this isn't metaphor. When I dropped the rock, I had blood on my hand. And that was The Ugly American by Shara Leslie, from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44, from the year 2020, edited by Bill Henderson. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.